And it gives me great pleasure to welcome the eloquent and ever versatile Nicholas Parsons to the show. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for that flattering introduction.
Although I can't promise the interview will be complete in just a minute, I will certainly do my best to avoid deviation, hesitation and repetition. As many of our listeners will know, you are the chairman of the best-loved comedy game show ever, Just a Minute. It's been on air for over 40 years and still going strong. Yeah. Did you ever imagine that when you first became involved, you'd still be chairing it to this day?
No, because it wasn't a very good pilot, and I didn't actually want the job. They originally had Jimmy Edwards lined up, but he was never free on a Sunday when they record the pilot. In radio and television, you record a pilot, and if the powers that be like it, then they commission a series. But I was persuaded to take the chairmanship for the pilot on the understanding that if we got the series, I'd be on the panel, which is what I wanted to do. And unfortunately, the pilot was pretty bad, and they didn't want the series. But a very young, clever producer who just joined the staff, called David Hatch, reasoned with them because he saw the potential for it. And I think because they wanted to keep David Hatch, not because they wanted us, we got a first series. But he said to me, I'm sorry, you're landed with it now, because one thing they liked on the pilot was your chairmanship. And I say in my one-man show, I must have done something right, because I'm still doing the job after 44 years. And it's amazing to think I haven't missed a performance. I've done 810 or 815 performances of Just a Minute.
Quite incredible, isn't it? And it's amazing how it came about, obviously meant to be.
I think that's part of the romance of show business. Sometimes it's from the big disasters you get amazing successes, because you learn from those and you build on it and adjust it and polish and do other things which help to produce a sort of format which achieves a longevity.
Yes, it's true, isn't it? I mean, clearly for a show like this, a quick wit is required. Who over the years has really impressed you with their ability to sustain this skill and entertain the audience at the same time?
Well, we have a number of regulars who play the game very, very well. It is extraordinarily difficult. And what we do is we try and make it look easy, but that's part of being a professional. And when some people say, oh, we've got people in our office, they've been very good at that, I said, no, I think it would be disaster, because you've got to be a skilled professional. You've got, and a lot of well-known professional names who've been on as guests and haven't done very well, they've struggled. And some just master their technique, and then they improve the more often they come back. And what the producer does now is there's a nucleus of regular players who are like the bankers. I mean, not the bankers, I hope they're not like the bankers, who are the secure rock on which each recording is based. And we often bring in somebody new, and if we find they can do it, then they get asked back. But, you know, we never have the same four names in any show, which does help to keep it fresh and different.
Absolutely, yes, you definitely notice that. I mean, you've been in hundreds of films and TV series, but tell us, did you ever have a plan for what you wanted to do, or did it just evolve? How did you get started in entertainment?
No plan at all. I just wanted to go become an actor from the earliest age I can remember. Admittedly, my parents encouraged me to show off in the nursery and do things, but when I was a bit older and they realized I was serious about it, they were horrified and did everything to stop me. And I actually became an engineer first to please them. And the war was on, so I couldn't very well get into show business anyway. So I am a qualified marine and mechanical engineer. I did 5 years on Clydebank. How I survived is a mystery, but it was just, I think, by using humor, which is the greatest catalyst, because I'd gone straight from an English public school and a protected middle-class professional family to the rough and tumble and aggression of Clydebank. You come up here and there we are. Whoa, what an accent it is. This is life, you know. This is loving. I said, what is it about? But don't worry, I mean, you're okay. You're mucky. I mean, you come up on there by chums, but, I mean, you'll have to adapt. You don't have to me, I mean, because...
showing your versatility.
I mean, I'll tell you, isn't it? We can teach you who to get your effing arms dirty. and they did. And I survived. And in retrospect, though it was tough and harsh and difficult, it was the greatest learning for life anybody could possibly have. But all the time I was escaping and doing little things in the theatre, amateur dramatics and amateur concert parties, entertaining the troops on the anti-aircraft sites, and a little local repertory company that did a rehearse every evening one week and played every next in Rutherglen, just outside Glasgow. So I was getting a lot of sort of raw, rough, early experience. So when the war was over and I gave up engineering, to my parents' horror, because I was qualified, and with no contacts or nothing, I just pursued it. And I always had the idea that, you know, work breeds work. So I took any job. I didn't ask what the money was. Just took one job, and one thing leads to another. So I've had no plan. I just enjoy working. I enjoy my professional work. And if something takes off, like Just a Minute, gosh, what a joy and what a pleasure that is. I mean, I was asked only yesterday to a guest in some strange, weird comedy show on television, and it's absolutely way out. And I said, yeah, of course I'll do it. Anything. I love doing different things. I didn't sort of say, wait a minute, is that me? Is that my image? Is that what I want to do? No, I've never had any plan at all.
Extremely open.
And if it was successful, you get more work.
That's true. Work breeds work, as they say. I mean, it's you are so versatile and very open to things, which a lot of interesting things there you're talking about would never have imagined our audience of yourself, maybe.
Well, all I can say is buy a copy of my memoirs. It came out last year. It's still available. It's called Nicholas Parsons, with Just a Touch of Hesitation, Repetition and Deviation, A Life in Comedy.
Yes.
And the paperback's coming out this August when I'm up in Edinburgh doing my comedy show again. And so far, it's been selling very well.
Fantastic.
But there's all kinds of anecdotes. And I've treated the memoirs, because I did an autobiography in the 90s. But how do you follow that up? There's a lot of things I've done since. So what we've done, I've done it in chapters. I've got a chapter on my early life, a chapter on Clive Bank, a chapter on all my film work, a chapter on all my radio work, a chapter on Just a Minute, a chapter on the Arthur Haynes Show, which was a very important part of my life. Which is now out on DVDs, by the way. And then a chapter on all my work in Edinburgh, a chapter on comedians, because I work with more comedians living and dead than anybody, and a chapter on the Rocky Horror Show, where I was in that show for about 3 or 4 years.
Yes, I remember that. Fantastic. You were great.
And so it's all based on chapters, so you can learn about me and my life, but in you can turn to a different chapter. It's concise in its own form.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's another whole chapter on Just a Minute.
It's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, you really do communicate in a number of forms. What was it that prompted you to write that? Just wanted to express everything?
It was commissioned. I hadn't thought about doing it. But they said, would you like to write some memoirs? I said, all right. They gave me a contract. I kept getting behind, because I'm the sort of person that works best under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly I started doing it, and I said, no, I was going to get tremendously far behind. And then, thanks to the chap who was my editor, I said, I'm not going to deliver on time, am I? He said, don't worry. He was a Scot as well. Don't worry. I know how these publishers work. They put you under pressure. But I tell you what, why didn't you resort to this idea of doing it in chapters? And it was his idea. I always like to give credit to people who do a lot of things. And it worked, because then I could condense some of the things, or reprise some of the things I've said in the autobiography. And so if you reprise something, you've got to find different ways to express it, which I hope I've done.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, just talking about Arthur Haynes there, and available on DVD. I mean, I guess as a theatre actor, you were used to adapting and improvising. Did this background help you when working with someone like Arthur Haynes?
Oh, entirely, because Arthur was from the world of variety or music hall. I come from the world of the legitimate theatre. Though I'd done a lot of stand-up. I've been resident comedian at the Windmill Theatre for quite a while. I'd done a lot of cabaret. But Arthur, I think he wasn't confident in a sketch format. And he never actually learned all the words. He learned the sense. He had a very good memory. But my memory was a bit superior, I think, because I managed to carry, because I've been all that time in rep, learning my craft as an actor. And I'm having to do quick study. So he would often dry up completely. And this was live television. And I would prompt him. And the public actually endured it, because they were all spontaneous and outrageous. Then he would start to improvise and ad lib. And I'd go with him. And it was very exciting. And I suppose, in a professional sense, we were living dangerously because, as I said, it was live television.
It's amazing, isn't it? I have to say, having been treated to the television repeats of Arthur Haynes and yourself, you seem to be able to almost know instinctively how to react to any kind of ad-lib or improvised scene that he threw at you.
I mean, that's what comes... That's professionalism experience. I mean, this is what happens in the young people. I mean, the question that always puzzles me is people say, what was your big break? I said, well, I've never had a big break. I've had lots of mini breaks. Like the Arthur Haynes show started... Oh, from a disaster, we built that one up into a huge success, and so you lose your experience, and nothing replaces experience. So nowadays, people think, oh, you have a big break, you're discovered on television or something has happened, but if you haven't got the experience of lots of work behind you, it's sometimes difficult to sustain that situation, and that's why often people who arrive very rapidly often fade very rapidly, and it was a slow, long, hard slog up the ladder of professional achievement and success. And so when that happens, you learn enough to be able to survive and cope with anything that is thrown at you.
That's right. It really is about longevity, isn't it? That's something that not everyone can sustain, but that you have done so beautifully.
Talking about ad-libbing, I mean, you see, Just a Minute is a entirely spontaneous show. We're all improvising immediately. And that's what makes it exciting, not only for us to do it, but also for the audience, because an audience knows instinctively if something's improvised or ad-libbed, and they know if something's scripted or not. And I maintain that the reason is they feel that they are present at a happening, at an event, and they're part of it, so it makes it rather exciting for them.
It's a wonderful moment, isn't it, in time, this kind of spark, and you know, everyone just gets involved with it. It must be a great feeling in the studio. I mean, what's your biggest lesson you've learnt about comedy timing from fellow comedians, would you say?
I don't know. I've never had a question like that before. Every comedian's different, but timing is instinctive. I mean, I've said before that the art of acting is timing, and the art of comedy acting is more superior timing. And you're given the gift of being able to play comedy or time a comedy line. But the more you do it, the more you refine it, the more you do it by instinct, and you don't have to practice it. It just comes out. And so it's always amazing. I mean, you listen to Paul Merton, who's the most brilliant improvised comedian, as he illustrates on Just a Minute and Have I Got News for You. But, I mean, I've watched Paul progress from modest beginnings to the stature he's achieved now. But the way his brain works, it's a wonderful comic creativity he has in his mind. And no one epitomizes spontaneous humor better than him. And all the others who are successful in Just a Minute have that great gift.
Yes.
And it is a gift. And,
yes.
But the more you use your gifts, the better they become.
Better it becomes, that's right. I mean, many people are aware of your impeccable timing, but maybe this is because you're more clockwise than others, because you're a keen horologist. Tell us a little bit about that.
No, there's no connection between horology and comedy timing. Comedy timing, I've just said it, is an instinct you're born with, but you need to hone it and improve it and polish it. Clocks are utterly organised and predictable. I mean, I love clocks. I love the fact that you've got a beautiful piece of furniture and it's talking to you and telling you things. But you've got to get it absolutely precise. It's predictable. It's exact. There's no improvisation in a clock. It's quite the antithesis of what we were talking about.
That's right. I mean, at least you can... Well, you can mostly rely on the clock, I guess, if it's set right.
We use the word timing because it's the way you deliver it. It's the timing of that. But it happens to be that it's related to telling the time. But telling the time with a clock is a precision business. And the more precise the clock is, the more superior it is. Does it time and time again exactly the same?
Yes. Yes, it's a well-oiled machine, I have to say. Well, I mean, may I just say that many people, and dyslexic like myself, are amazed to discover that you're actually dyslexic yourself. What did you do to try and overcome this?
Well, they didn't know what it was when I was young. They just thought I was slow, and my parents thought I wasn't going to achieve anything. I got no help with it at all. But I did very well at school. I got through my exams. And I realise now, from having talked to the people who teach at a dyslexic school, where I gave the prizes away at one time, is that if you're dyslexic, you begin to rely on your memory. Now, maybe they teach them to do that, but I instinctively did. And I learned all the stuff I had to, committed it to memory, and got through my exams. Now, that obviously illustrates to me that I was using my memory instinctively, but very positively. So the result is I am now blessed with a very good memory, and that's the reason I can do just a minute, because, remember, I have no backup. If someone makes a challenge, I have to immediately, in order to keep the show going and keep the fun going, I have to know immediately, did they repeat that word a few seconds earlier? Was it a hesitation? Make instant decisions and move on. And it requires, I have to concentrate. In fact, it's the biggest job of concentration, just a minute, that I've got. But it's, I suppose it is my memory, because where the drawbacks are, that I read slowly, and I have a lot of scripts to read and a lot of other stuff, and that is a great drawback. I'd love to read much more. I read the newspapers. I like to keep up with what's going on. But I wish I had time to read more books. And it is because I read so slowly. But mind you, what I know, and any dyslexic teacher would tell you, I retain far more because of the memory bank.
I think quite incredible. It really is. As a dyslexic, I just can't believe it, really, the amount that... But you do concentrate. The concentration is incredibly intense.
Absolutely.
At a dyslexic. So I guess it takes it to another level sometimes, but still quite amazing, I have to say. I mean, any dyslexic knows...
Sorry,
yes.
Show you what a battle it was. I also had a stutter, or a stammer, as we called it when I was young.
Oh.
No, it's called a stammer now. Mm. It's called a stutter then. And when I got nervous and tense or anxious, it used to get worse. But I worked on that, and I discovered it was to do with breathing. And I find by having some voice production breathing lessons when I was getting started as a professional, I was able to get control of my breath like a singer does, and that helped me with the stutter.
That's wonderful for people to know who do have a stammering problem, because it can be connected as well, all sorts of different things with dyslexia and autism and various things. But I mean, any dyslexic knows that words could be a challenge. And if I'm correct, in 2009, you helped children test their vocabulary by playing Parson's Nose, a new daily conundrum, and adopt a word created by ICANN, the charity with communication charity. Tell us a little bit about this children's charity and why you believe it's so vital.
They do a lot of work. I was asked to adopt a word, and the word I adopted was joy, because I think it's wonderful to create joy in life, and life should be more joyous. There's so many pressures and tensions that people experience in their lives, especially once they leave school, with all the problems of trying to earn a living and the unemployment that's around and all the other things, that, you know, you can get so tense that you forget to laugh and have fun. And to be in a profession where you're trying to create joy for others is a great privilege. And I think, therefore, joy is a wonderful word.
Oh, that is a wonderful word. That's fantastic. I mean, with your busy schedule, it's a wonder that you have any spare time at all. But, however, I believe you are a patron of Deafblind UK, the Spring Centre, and the Stammering Association.
I'm far more doing for other charities like the Lord's Taverners, where I've been associated with 45 years.
Yes.
And we do lots of things like cricket matches, golf matches, dinners and so forth. And I was doing a thing over the weekend for them. I no longer turn out and play cricket for them. Bit old for that, but I do commentaries and things like that, and I make speeches, and been with them for a lot, and that's all to help underprivileged and disadvantaged youngsters, and also for the Variety Club, of course, the Grand Order of Water Rats. And yes, I was very active with Deafblind UK for a time. I'm a trustee there, but it's all my positive charity work is with children and Childline, which is another wonderful organisation, which is now part of the NSPCC, and they've always done wonderful work, and I've also helped them. Yeah, you do find time, and there's an old saying, isn't there? If you want something done, get a busy person to do it.
Yes.
But in between, I try to find time to get into the garden, because not only am I a keen gardener, but I find it the most therapeutic and relaxing activity you can possibly think of. I don't get so much time to keep up with my sporting interests. I would like to play more golf and get out on the greens, but unfortunately it doesn't happen because I've got so busy professionally. But you don't like to turn it down, because when you've experienced those years when you were struggling for recognition and you needed every little job to keep going, you know, you get a bit nervous if someone asks you to do another job and you think, oh, because if I turn it down, they may never ask me again.
It's that feeling never really goes, I suppose, when you're in the profession.
Well, not when you struggle very hard to get recognition.
Mm.
And anybody who is successful has struggled very hard. It's a tough, tough business. There's no
certainly is.
And you're only, there's no better truer phrase, you're only as good as your last job. And you might do a job in an after dinner somewhere or a personal appearance where, you know, the conditions are not right. And nothing to do with you, because the microphone wasn't right or the lighting or something, or the you don't go over as well as usual. And, you know, those people will go off you, and the employers will probably not ask you again. It's really, I don't think people realise.
No, you're always living on your wits.
20 successes, and you have one show which doesn't go well, and that's the one they remember.
Well, luckily you do fantastic shows, but I'm talking of after-dinner speeches. I believe you achieved a place in the Guinness Book of Records for the longest after-dinner speech. You spoke for 11 hours non-stop for a children's charity, I presume without the deviation, hesitation and repetition?
Oh, no, because that would have been impossible. we were hesitating, deviating and repeating ourselves all the time, because I did it in competition with Giles Brandreth.
Oh, yes.
So we held it together.
Yes.
And we had a proper dinner, and we had rules where you couldn't be, you know, had to be consistently amusing or entertaining, otherwise you'd be ruled out of order. And so I did. And of course the small audience there knew what you were trying to achieve. So if I recycled some material in a different way, they knew. They weren't saying, going to shout out, "Oh, we've heard it," and heckle you for it. They just laughed at the idea of you keeping going.
Absolutely, yeah, it's amazing. I remember Giles Brandreth was on last year talking about his world record. I didn't know you were with him as well, so that's fantastic.
Yes, but you see, Giles is very, very more competitive than I am, and he was a bit niffed when we held it together for a time, so he went for it again and got it.
Ah, I see. Now, of course, not only will you be heading to the renowned Edinburgh Fringe with the Just a Minute team, but you'll also be performing, no doubt, another triumphant one-man show. So without giving away too much, what special treats do people have in store?
I give away as much as I can.
Go on, then.
Let people to come and see it.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep my show secret.
Anything in store that people can look forward to compared to previous years?
There's a programme up there I do. I've been doing it now for 11 years. No, 10 years. I'm going back for the 11th successive year. It's called the Nicholas Parsons Happy Hour, where I do a lot of stand-up comedy, improvisational comedy with the audience. And then I have guests. I have people on the different shows on the Fringe who come on, and we chat about their shows, help to promote them for them. And I call it comedy and chat. And, you know, I gag with the audience and tell jokes. But principally, it's the celebrity guests who, you know, and I empathise with them in order to have more fun.
Sounds like it's going to be another great show, and audiences are going to be in for a treat to pop up to Edinburgh and see you in action. So thank you so much for talking with us today, and very good luck with the show. I'm sure it's going to be a resounding success.
Suzanne, lovely to talk to you, and thank you for being such a very good and charming interview.
Oh, thank you very much. It means a lot coming from you, Nicholas. And that was the multi-talented Nicholas Parsons, who'll be at the Edinburgh Festival with his one-man show, Happy Hour. Brooklyn's Radio.